before the argument starts. This case is People of the State of Colorado versus Jonathan Estes. It's been set for oral argument for 15 minutes per side. We advise counsel that if they can use the 15 minutes any way they please, but we also advise them that we have read the briefs. We have read some of the authority cited in the briefs. We believe we understand the facts and the law, at least to the extent it's been briefed. And the one of the members of the division, and in today's electronic records, maybe more than one member of the division, has been into the record. And so we're not only familiar with the briefs, but the record. Counsel can use their time any way they please. We would recommend, and do recommend, that they go directly to the legal arguments involved, because we think we're familiar with the facts, and the time is limited. The appellant may reserve time for rebuttal. There's a digital clock system that keeps track of time. You'll see one module of that on my desk, and you'll see another one on the lectern. The light will be green during the first 10 minutes of the argument. It will turn yellow or orange during the last 5 minutes of the argument and turn red when the argument's over. The module also has a reverse countdown clock so that if the appellant wants to keep track of his own time, he may. If you want some assistance with that, I'll be happy to give you a high sign when you reach the time you want to reserve. We ask that counsel stay near the lectern. We ask them to do that because not only is the sound microphone there so you can hear it, hear the argument, but also the microphone that records the arguments. We record all arguments. We frequently consult the argument, the recording, in the preparation of an opinion. And we like to have counsel stay near the lectern so that we can get a clear recording. We also digitally record the arguments, and those, they're posted on the internet. I believe that will be true today, although I haven't checked the recording equipment, and you'll be able to listen to the oral arguments on the internet on the court webpage at your leisure for, I don't know how long, but for an indefinite period. And lastly, we would ask that you turn off any electronic devices. I know you've been asked that before, but I have contempt power. So I want to ask you again, turn off the your cell phones, your Blackberries, your iPhones, anything else that goes bump in the night and can cause a disturbance when you least expect it. That may be your neighbor. But nonetheless, please turn them off so as not to disturb the court or counsel in the course of the argument. Are there any questions from counsel, what we've been through? Do you want to help reserving time? One or 2 minutes? I'll try to tell you when you have two. We're ready to proceed with People versus Estes.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ari Kritchever, registration 37780. I represent the appellant, Jonathan Estes. There were three issues raised on appeal. I'd like to spend the bulk of my time discussing the first issue, the confrontation issue, and as time permits, I'd like to get to the third issue, as I said, if there's any time. This case gives us an opportunity to examine the bounds of the confrontation clause. And the issue here is whether the statements that the victim made to the police after the shooting are testimonial or not. And I think a brief review of the facts is helpful. There were two sets of statements made when the police found the victim. The police find the victim lying on his front lawn, bleeding from the neck. And he's first approached by Officer Bruce. And Officer Bruce gets a description of the suspects, a description which, in fact, does not actually match my client, the description of my client, but gets a description of the suspects. The victim is then loaded into an ambulance, and Officer Nebel gets into the ambulance with the victim. and proceeds to question him in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. And it's the second set of statements that are at issue here.
Is there other evidence in the record other than the victim's statement that is evidence of the fact that this victim, who was found some distance from the site of the shooting, was in fact the victim of that shooting?
Are you asking whether there was...
Yeah, but independent of these statements made by the victim, is there any other evidence in the record that ties the victim found in the front lawn of a residence with the park and ride parking lot where the shooting occurred?
The only other evidence would be the statements of Miss Young, which is my client's girlfriend, maybe wife, which of course are the key sort of this entire case, were her statements to the police implicating my client in this shooting.
What about the description of the car that he was driving?
Well, and that comes from pretty much all of the evidence in this case comes from Miss Young.
The bus drivers at the scene of the shooting that identified the car?
They did. There were actually two RTD employees that testified as eyewitnesses that identified the car and also identified the three potential suspects.
Was the car found near where the victim was found?
Yes, it was.
And it had blood in it, I assume?
Yes, okay. It did. And so the issue is whether that second set of statements that the victim made to Officer Neville in the ambulance are testimonial or not. And this, a division of this court very recently addressed a factually similar situation in People v. Hagos, where the court addressed a similar question about whether the statements were testimonial. And there we had a similar situation in which there's a shooting, and then the police interview the shooting victim, and admittedly that victim was not injured in that case.
Let's assume that I agree with you that it's testimony. So what? If all of the evidence was available elsewhere in the record, including the fact that he was the victim, this gentleman that was picked up, what does this evidence add to the evidence that incriminates you?
The key to this case, the key issue in this case, as the Attorney General put in their answer brief, was Miss Young's credibility. The jury had a very straightforward decision to make. Do they believe her story at trial, where she says this is all a lie and it was completely made up and my client had nothing to do with it? Or do they believe her story to the police that she gave within the weeks following the shooting that implicated my client? And there is really nothing to corroborate her story to the police except for really one thing. And that one thing is that she said to the police that my client said to her that he just shot some guy for his rims, you know, the wheels on his car. The victim in the ambulance on the way to the hospital says to Officer Neville that the shooter said to me before he shot me, give me your ride.
And that's, say that again.
The shooter said, give me your ride. Give me your car.
That means take the car.
I'm sorry?
That means take the car.
Yes. And so this is really the only thing to corroborate Miss Young's statement to the police. This connection between her saying that my client said I just shot some guy for his rims and the victim saying that the shooter told me give me your ride. There's really nothing else. There's no physical evidence to implicate my client. The descriptions of the shooter by the impartial eyewitnesses don't match my client. And so we really have nothing. And so when the jury goes back to decide which version they're going to believe, whether, in other words, is she lying at trial or not, well, now they suddenly have a piece that corroborates her story to the police. They have this connection with the car. And there's really nothing else that they have to weigh her credibility.
Well, now the statements the victim made to Officer Neville in the ambulance, wasn't there some description of the shooter?
There was a description of the shooter.
And that description was different than what was first said when the victim was lying on the yard, on the ground.
I think that it was largely the same. I think there might have been some additional details about what the shooter was wearing.
And that matched what other eyewitnesses testified as to who was the shooter?
In a very general sense, meaning, you know, he said that the shooter was wearing a red shirt, and the eyewitnesses said the shooter was wearing a red shirt. So to that extent.
Was the defendant ever connected to a red shirt?
There was some testimony, I believe, from Ms. Young that earlier in the day he had been wearing a red shirt. So yes, we have that he was wearing a red shirt. I'm not sure how many people were wearing a red shirt that day.
A lot of people at this high school wore red shirts.
I think that's probably right. The Attorney General points to this sort of ongoing medical emergency. You know, one piece of this analysis is whether the questions from Officer Neble were designed to resolve an ongoing emergency. And the Attorney General points to the fact that that the victim had suffered a life-threatening injury, an injury that ultimately rendered him unable to testify at trial. And I would only point to I don't have the case at my fingertips. The questions from Officer Neble had nothing to do with any medical emergency. I don't think there's any argument that Officer Neble was actually doing anything to assist in treating the victim. I don't think that he played any role in the actual medical treatment. And I don't think that there's really any argument that his questions were designed to resolve the medical emergency. He had a gunshot wound to his neck. That was very clear, I think, to the paramedics that were attending to the victim.
Doesn't the red shirt provide at least some tie-in? If other eyewitnesses said shooter was wearing a red shirt, the victim said that, and the defendant's girlfriend said that, doesn't that corroborate at least what she said early on?
I mean, I guess it does in a very general sense. You know, just meaning that
it's corroborating.
It is corroborating, and I'm not sure what weight I would give to that corroboration. But you're correct.
I expect I know what weight you would want to give. But.
Yeah, it is some corroboration. I think that the statement about the car is a hard fact that we have that. That is the tie-in between the victim's statement to Officer Neble and Ms. Young's story to the police.
How hard was that particular fact, the give me a ride, and tied to Ms. Young's statement in closing argument?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand.
In closing argument, did the prosecution make a lot of that particular corroboration, that is, with regard to stealing the car?
No, I can't recall off the top of my head what weight was given to that in closing argument.
Wouldn't that be important for us to figure out whether this is harmless error or not?
I mean, the fact is out there. The fact was presented to the jury. So, you know, to the extent that the prosecutor relied on that, I guess that would weigh into, you know, how harmless it may or may not have been. But it was presented as evidence, and the fact was out there for the jury to consider.
What's your best argument that it's not harmless? The fact that this one statement?
Yes. Which I think is important, and this is kind of a good tie-in to the third issue, that the key, as I said before, the key at this trial was Ms. Young's credibility. And the jury really had one decision to make. If they believe her at trial, then they acquit. And if they believe her statement to the police, then they convict.
How long did the jury deliberate?
3 days.
That's a long deliberation.
It's a long deliberation. And if there aren't any more questions on the confrontation issue, I'd like to jump to the third issue, the motion for new trial. And I want to start with the second ground for the motion for new trial, which was the service of process to Ms. Summers, who and some of the facts are important here too. Ms. Summers is Ms. Young's cousin. Ms. Summers initially gave the same story to police, implicating my client. But then when it came time to trial, she decided she didn't want to testify anymore because presumably for the same reasons that Ms. Young was writing letters to the court saying that this was all a lie, that my client had nothing to do with any of this.
There is some evidence, is there not, of threats from your client to his girlfriend about this?
There were some conversations between my client and his girlfriend. I presume you're talking about the conversations while he was in custody.
Right.
I'm not sure I would characterize them as threats. I mean,
what did he say? That wasn't disputed what he said.
It was not. And
you think that's not a threat?
Well, I guess the reason I wouldn't characterize
this. Just tell me what he said.
See if I can put my finger on it. I'm sorry, I don't have that piece right in front of me.
Well, didn't he basically say blow her away or words to that effect?
I'm sorry?
Blow her away or words to that effect, if she testified. I realize he's not charged with that, but...
And what I don't think he was doing is I don't believe that he was attempting to get her to lie at trial. My reading of that was that he was trying to get her to not keep up with the story, this completely made up story that she had initially told the police.
You want to reserve 2 minutes?
Yes, I would, thank you.
You have a minute, if you want.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Susan Friedman. My registration number is 34450, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this case. I would also like to begin with the ongoing emergency issue. In this case, I feel like this is a perfect example of a time when attorneys get caught up in our six-part tests and our eight-part factors and parsing out every tiny little fact and seeing if it meets exactly the facts that were presented to the United States Supreme Court in a different case to decide if this testimony is admissible. And I would just urge the court to step back and look at the entire situation, that the test requires that we examine the totality of the circumstances. And here, a reasonable, objective witness would certainly think that these statements were made during an ongoing emergency. We are minutes after the shooting. The victim,
how far away from the site of the shooting are we?
1/2 mile.
How much time between the shooting and where we are now?
Well, that was not testified to with precision, but we do know that it was a severe neck injury. So
I'm not questioning there was a medical
injury. No, I mean,
The question is whether tucked into the ambulance, going to the hospital with a policeman on board, there's any real thought that the shooter's going to show up again.
I think there could be. I think that we discount that by saying that he is safe because he's in the ambulance.
Well, but is there any evidence that the victim, when he was talking either to Officer Bruce in the yard or Officer Neville in the ambulance, had any fear or concern that shooter was going to appear?
No, there was no testimony, but I mean, all he was able to say was a very brief description answering to the question, who shot you?
And aren't we supposed to be looking at what his state of mind is?
No, actually, we're supposed to be acting as a reasonable onlooker, an objective, reasonable person who is examining the totality of the circumstances. This is a different test for the ongoing emergency than we usually have for Confrontation Clause, which would be, does the declarant reasonably expect his statements to be used in a prosecution? We're not looking at that here. We're just looking at not whether the police think it's an ongoing emergency, not whether the victim does, but objectively, from the outside, do we have an emergency?
So you're saying that it's reasonable for an objective onlooker to believe that when there's a police car parked in front of the victim's yard, and there's a police officer in the yard, that someone may come up and try to harm the victim further?
Well, I don't know if they would do it under those circumstances, but I could imagine a case where, well, I just want to back up a moment. We don't know the motive here. At the point when Officer Nibble's in the ambulance asking questions, we don't know if these shooters knew him, they had a reason to shoot him. We do know that after they shot him and he got away, that they have a reason to want to finish the job so that he can't testify against them.
How would they do that in the ambulance? He's in an ambulance with the police.
They could follow the ambulance and ambush him as they try to take him into the ER. I mean, it may sound far-fetched, but it's not. It happens.
The more far-fetched it is, the more less likely a reasonable person would believe it.
That's true, but I don't believe that the ongoing emergency has to be tied to the victim. I don't think it has to be the victim in danger. In the U.S. Supreme Court cases, it was, because those were domestic violence cases. So we had an attacker and a victim, and we know who they were, we knew what the motive was, we knew once they were separated and the defendant was handcuffed, that there was no more emergency. We don't know anything here. Are these guys on a shooting spree? Are they running through the neighborhood with their semi-automatic weapons?
Did the police put armed guards at the victim's hospital room?
There was no testimony about that, whether that's standard practice or not.
There was no emergency with respect to at least the defendant or whoever the shooter was.
Well, no one asked a question about that, so it's not in the record.
Was there a record to show why Officer Neville got in the ambulance?
Because he thought that the victim would soon die and he wanted to get information out as soon as possible. It doesn't defeat, a statement is not necessarily testimonial just because it also could serve the purpose of being used at trial in a prosecution. That's going to be true almost always of any statement from the victim.
Does the emergency doctrine apply to just wanting to go arrest whoever did this? Or is it to provide safety and protection?
Well, right after the court in Davis mentioned the emergency exception, they cited the New York versus Quarles case, which is our traditional Fifth Amendment public safety exception. So I think that suggests that they were talking about public safety more so than specifically whether the victim was safe. So in this case, I mean, we're looking at the victim who had a police officer at his side, paramedics, he follows him into the ambulance, but there's a parallel investigation going on at this crowded park and ride where there was just a shooting in front of a whole bunch of school-aged kids in broad daylight at the RTD. And the assailants fled. So the police are also there, presumably, looking for them. And it would help if they knew what they were wearing, or that there were two or three, or whether they had handguns, or whether they had automatic weapons. That's very important for the police to know to be able to address the ongoing emergency.
Now the recent shooting in Fort Hood, Texas, it might be fairly difficult to determine when the life-threatening emergency is over and when the investigation and the treatment begins. But that's a much more complex circumstance than we have here. Here we have one shooter, one person, mm-hmm. that for a mile and a half or whatever from the site of the shooting, it's quite a different set of facts.
Well, it is and it isn't, because the police shot and wounded and disabled the shooter in the Fort Hood case. They knew who it was and they had him.
They didn't know he was the only one.
They didn't know he was the only one, that's true.
Did they know there was only one shooter here at that time?
Well, the initial statements to Officer Bruce was a light-skinned black man in a red shirt shot me. In the ambulance, he said it was two men, and they both had semi-automatic weapons. And then he again said red shirt. Added black bandana.
Just for the sake of argument, let's assume that we don't agree with you on the emergency issue. What is your response to counsel's argument that the statement about give me your ride is crucial evidence in the case?
Well, I would agree that that is the only corroboration for the auto theft motive. That the victim said it, he said, give me your ride, and Young said several different statements basically implying the same thing, that he was shot for his car. I don't know that the jury is going to convict Mr. Estes of shooting him, because it is sure that the person at the RTD said, give me your ride. I just don't see it as like the linchpin to the case. I think you were...
What connects the victim in the front yard of, maybe it was his house.
Yeah, his house.
Shot in the neck with the shooting that occurred in the parking lot.
It's actually his...
Other than this statement that the victim said in the statement that Ms. Young's...
It's actually his vehicle. There was a photograph in the record of the vehicle, and it was a bright red SUV with raised up off the ground with huge, shiny, spinning hubcaps. It was the, both RTD bus drivers testified that's what they noticed. They noticed that car come in, and they looked at it. That's how they ended up witnessing this shooting. It was a very distinct car, and the RTD officers, I believe, or officers, drivers, I believe, identified a photograph of the vehicle they saw at trial. And I did want to correct, I think defense counsel said that they were able to identify the assailants, but it's my recollection that nobody was able to identify once Ms. Young implicated the defendant and the other people that were with him. Photo lineups were given, and the drivers could not identify them. Just to clear that up.
So the only evidence identifying the defendant here is the evidence of Ms. Young, correct?
Yes. And her mother. She told her mother the same thing, and also the cousin told the mother the same thing. But, yes. And I did want to also answer a question was asked about whether the prosecutor emphasized this evidence in closing. And my recollection, I wrote on page 15 of the answer brief, the statements weren't even mentioned in initial closing argument by either party. It came up in rebuttal, and it was limited to the red shirt, the black pants. And in fact, the attorney said, hey, give it whatever weight you want. This is some more evidence for you to consider. It was not, he specifically said, I am not asking you to hang your hat on what somebody saw. So definitely, Ms. Young's testimony was the evidence.
Doesn't 3 days of jury deliberation seem a little bit long and indicate that the case is not strong?
Well, I don't know that we can presume that because we don't know what they couldn't agree on. It's, I mean, the case was contested. They may not have been able to. I mean, it's just, you could have endless speculation, excuse me, on why it took so long. And honestly, we just don't have enough information about what jurors do and how they spend their time. And
did jurors send out any notes that are
I do not recall from the record. They did view Ms. Young's videotaped statement to the police. I'm fairly certain they did view that a second time.
Wait
a
second.
Maybe, okay. So that was considered. Just a quick comment on the Hagos case. I don't find that to be dispositive because although the court says in the beginning of the analysis that it found these statements to be testimonial, the case was remanded for the trial court to determine whether the same statements were testimonial. So I'm not thinking that it's resolved.
What about the issue of the motion for new trial? The apparent recordings of someone else admitting they were the shooter.
Well, the recordings were very poor quality, and the only somewhat, it was sort of interpreted, I believe, a law clerk or an assistant to defense counsel listened to it and transcribed it, but the statements they were able to understand were minutes apart, so we don't even know if the answers are responsive to the questions. It really was not very incriminating.
Well, but your star witness said that he did say that.
That's right.
That the cousin did admit to the killing.
That's right. And she said that he admitted that to her on the night of the crime. So that was information that was available. Defense counsel, of course, you know, couldn't necessarily have gotten this gentleman to admit to the crime, but they didn't subpoena him. They didn't attempt to interview him. He was named from day one.
And there was evidence at trial that he had been the shooter, wasn't there? Didn't the mother, wasn't there some evidence from either the mother or present that said he was the shooter?
I do not recall that coming up at trial. I think they were concerned, the family members were concerned that he was involved and may have been the shooter and initially wanted to protect him. There was some testimony about that, or speculating that they wanted to protect him.
But there was some evidence that there were two people involved.
Oh, definitely. I believe there were three.
And Ms. Young said he was involved. The cousin was involved.
Yes. Well, she said that, and then she went back and said, well, I don't know for sure. I just assumed that because they're always together. So, but yes, there was some evidence that he was there, that he was involved, which I think is all the more reason to interview him as a possible suspect. Like, I can't imagine how this is newly discovered surprise evidence that couldn't have been uncovered with due diligence. And that's something the defendant has to show in order to be entitled to a new trial.
There was no complicity theory.
There was not. Had there been additional information, pointing fingers at different shooters, there may have been. But the evidence did not warrant a complicity instruction as it was.
What about the dropping of the contempt proceeding against the witness, K.S.? The prosecutor did, in closing, argue that Ms. Young was lying and saying that K.S. wasn't present when the subpoena was served as a way of attacking her credibility. Now, based on these new developments, it appears that maybe K.S. was in fact not served. Doesn't that suggest that maybe this is evidence that we need to consider?
I don't think it's material. I don't think that it's something that's going to undermine the fundamental fairness of the trial. Ms. Summers would have, we don't know what she would have testified to, but if she had contradicted her statements, then her previous inconsistent statements would have been admissible, just like Ms. Young's were. And the discussion between the prosecutor and Ms. Young did reveal that defendant's sister pretended to be Ms. Summers. I think that's how they were informed of what had happened. Ms. Summers was, or Ms. Estes, the defendant's sister, was pretending to be Ms. Summers, and Ms. Young knew about that and didn't disclose it. So I don't think it necessarily, would have been something that would have changed the outcome. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have a minute 51, sir.
I'd like to focus on the motion for new trial issue. The fact is that we have evidence that another person committed this crime, a crime that my client is sitting in prison for 45 years. And yes, we had evidence at trial that maybe someone else was involved in the shooting. Maybe this other cousin was there. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. But now we actually have evidence from his own mouth where he's talking about using the gun. He talks about the gun. He talks about being there. And we have that.
Is it from his own mouth or from Ms. Young's mouth?
The recording is from his own mouth.
Nobody seems to be able to understand.
Much of it is unintelligible. But what we can hear is him talking about cocking the gun. I think his statement was, the victim leaned out the window and I cocked my shit again. That's what his statement was. I mean, here we have another person who is admitting to using the gun at the shooting.
Well, he's admitting having one, at least. Cocking a gun is different than firing.
I suppose that's true.
And Ms. Young changing her testimony, the question was from Judge Roy if this was a threat, and I looked it up, see if this is what you recall. Young, Estes called her when he was in the jail and said he was going to, quote, gonna shoot up her house. She was a little bit afraid because he had beaten her in the past. Recorded phone calls from the jail revealed that your client told Young that, quote, if she didn't come to court, nobody would be able to testify because all they had is her and Kay, and they would not be able to play her video. And then Young said, what are you going to do, beat me up again, kill me this time? And your client replied, I'm going to beat the something out of you something. And if she didn't come to visit, he would, quote, smoke her. That doesn't sound like a threat to you?
It certainly sounds like a threat. But I think the question is, what is he trying to get her to do? What is his objective?
I think he said that, didn't he?
And his objective is for her to not testify at trial and for her video statement to the police to not be played at trial. And the reason is because it's all a lie. It was a completely fabricated story.
And she was important evidence.
She was really the only evidence. I think that's right. I see that my time is up.
Yeah, we're out of time. Sorry, counsel. That will conclude the arguments. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. The court will be in recess, subject to call, and the bailiff may so announce.